1935, the Lions win the NFL championship. The Detroit Tigers take the World Series. The Red Wings bring home Lord Stanley's Cup. Joe Louis begins his rise to world domination. This transforms the Motor City into Detroit, City of Champions.
There you go, and with the crack of the bat, we are off.
Thought of the leather, Jamie. We're into boxing now.
That is it, yeah. It's Detroit, City of Champions, a trilogy of books written by
Charles Avison.
And I'm Jamie Flanagan, and we're getting deep into it, checking out the story.
In a new studio.
In a new space, yeah.
Love the new studio.
Yeah, I'm kind of pretty happy with how things are coming together here. So if anything goes awry, it's because this is actually the inaugural broadcast.
Awesome,
here.
Man.
Yeah, this is. I did a test run with the guy who owns the building, kind of interviewed him a little bit and talked about the building. But this is the first actual podcast that's gone.
That's cool. We have security downstairs.
Yeah, did you have to sign in?
Take the elevator up. She's nice. Nice girl.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Security. She's sweet. It was raining one day, and she's like, she walked me out to my car with her umbrella.
Oh, my God.
I know.
This is full on concierge here.
Really? Yeah. Seriously.
They call up to get dinner reservations or something. Okay. I'll take it a little
too far. Sandwich out of the vending machine. Okay. She'll run it up.
Concierge here.
That was pretty sweet, though. So.
No, that's great. I love the setup. It's great. It's great, man.
Thanks. So I think it looks
guys,
it's
some great work setting it up.
See that on the videos. If anybody wants to, make some noise themselves, we're always helping people launch podcasts with Podcast Detroit. Just reach out to me. All the links are all over the things because people, if you look at the show notes, you can like and subscribe, follow along wherever you're listening or watching. Just follow, like, subscribe, leave a comment. We enjoy the hell out of when people leave comments.
Oh, it's great. We get some great comments too, man.
And it's the family members that have been reaching out.
Yeah, we've
it's
had
been,
family members, some of the people we talked about reaching
touching.
Out. It's really cool.
It's moving. So people care and are appreciating what we're doing, and so we appreciate you taking the time and being with us. So Detroit City of Champions, like it wherever you find it. We need some YouTube likes, though.
I know. We need to build it up. I mean, slowly but surely, I've heard that it takes a little time to build it up.
Yeah, because you have to have a certain number of subscribers to get a custom... You know, because right now it's just youtube.com/gobbledygook. youtube.com/Detroit City of Champions.
Sure.
But you have to have X number of people before you can do that. So, hey, X people, help out a little bit.
It takes time, you know what I mean? Maybe we can break some sound bites out of it.
Sure.
And, subscribe
wherever fine podcasts are sold. Talking about Joe Louis, right? We're into episode three of.
Part three of the Joe Louis section, episode 40 overall. We've done 40 episodes.
Yeah,
so
can you believe
far.
It?
Yeah,
we've made
rolling,
it that
man.
Long. These two weary travelers we called ourselves earlier.
Yeah, no, we've been. It's great because we get to like kind of really dive into some take our time through it, which is cool. And what we're talking about today is a perfect example because, like, when I started doing the notes for today's show, I was like, usually when I tell this story of Joe Louis, the intro part of Joe Louis, it's a lot of it's warp speed ahead. You just go, oh, he did this, and then he did that, and then he did this, and then even when you're watching a documentary, the best existing documentary was HBO did a documentary on Joe Louis. It's probably the best. There's no movie. There's no A-list celebrity movie. Right. Like Jamie Foxx did a movie about Muhammad Ali. There's other boxers.
Jamie Foxx or Will Smith?
I'm sorry, Will. It was Will Smith. Yeah, Will Smith. Yeah, yeah.
Jamie Foxx did everybody else.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, you're right. No, it was. Yeah, Will Smith. Yeah. Yeah, Will. You're right.
A bunch
yeah.
Of other people.
Yeah, but then there's like
Jamie Foxx in one.
No. You're right. You're right. And then, but there's been other documentaries made about boxers. But Joe Louis, who's one of the most influential, if not like the most influential boxer ever.
Right.
There's been nothing. The only real legitimate film or any type of movie. Type work done on him was there's an HBO documentary done which was pretty good. It kind of warped speed ahead through 1935 for him.
Yeah.
And so, but even that, when they talk about, you know, his early life and, you know, what we're going to be talking about today, it's like they cover it in like 10 seconds.
So,
you know, and so that's what's cool is we get to actually take our time and kind of dive into a little bit more detail about some of his early life and what led him to, you know, that's one of my favorite things about people, especially people that come from nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, Joe Louis is the ultimate example of somebody that started off with, like, he was the last person, if you, like, knew Joe Louis when he was 12, 15, 17 years old.
Right.
He is like literally the last person on earth you would ever expect to rise up to be like one of the great
animals. Champion, not just the Negro League of Black Champions.
The heavyweight, yeah.
Yes. Champion of the world.
Yeah, and I say that he's one of the most influential and important people the entire 20th century, not just boxer, but just people who lived in the 20th century. His impact, and not just, you know, we're making a case, you know, this entire segment of the Joe Louis, this whole thing we're doing with Joe Louis, you know, as per the title, the most important, you know, the greatest individual. The whole point of this Joe Louis segment is not just to tell a story, but we're going to lay out a case for why 1935 Joe Louis was the greatest individual season in American sport history.
And you're rising up from the ashes, as it were. We were talking about movies a little bit, and then there's the one really well-known movie, the Cinderella.
Yeah, there's a whole movie on James Braddock. Yeah,
Cinderella Man.
Yeah.
And how does he cross paths?
We'll get to that.
And so
it crossed in 35. That movie happens in 1935.
And so, but Joe Louis is so much bigger.
He's 10 times bigger. He's 100 times bigger.
And Joe's story is so much
bigger. Yeah, just to give it a quick example, a teaser I actually like to use Cinderella Man as an example. I like to use that movie as an example because in 1935, it was Joe Louis. There was an award that's called the Most Outstanding Athlete of the Year. Mm-hmm. It was given out by the Associated Press, and it could go to any athlete in any sport. And so James Braddock, who's the subject of the movie Cinderella Man, he had 3 votes for the Associated Press Most Outstanding Athlete of the Year. Joe Louis, he has 187.
Yeah.
187, he wins it. You know, he wins this award. So 1935 was Joe Louis's year. And so yet they made a movie about Cinderella Man, $100 million Hollywood movie. Russell Crowe, it's a great movie. I'm not trying to take anything away from the accomplishments of James Braddock. But if this is a $100 million movie for James Braddock, you know what I mean? If this is an A-list Hollywood $100 million movie for what James Braddock did in 1935, Joe Louis at the time got the Associated Press Most Outstanding Athlete of the Year in the same sport as James Braddock. Where's his movie? Where's his $100 million Hollywood movie?
Yeah. No,
and it shouldn't just be a $100 million movie. It should be a billion-dollar movie or something, you know, because like what he did was literally, I mean, just from that, you know, mathematical equation, you know, what's 187 divided by 3? You know, that it was at least 90 times, you know, 70 times better, you know, like a bit more bigger.
So that's what I'm saying. And so, but we're really going to take our time.
Yes. And that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Get to that interview.
Yeah. Oh, we will. Absolutely.
About that.
Yeah. But the teaser to that component is, you know, a lot of people have seen Cinderella Man, and it's like, if you love that movie, you love what James Braddock did in 1935, wait till you hear what Joe Louis did. That's why the entire arc of this Joe Louis component is to make a case for why 1935 with Joe Louis was the greatest individual season in American sport history. That's what the component. Yeah, I think so.
So Joe had a lot of things to face and overcome.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Jack Johnson was
the shadow of Jack Johnson. Yeah, that was number one.
And he was so flamboyant, and he was so out there, and he angered people on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah,
which made Joe's job and Joe's accomplishments that
impossible. Yeah, I mean, after it was all said and done, it made it unbelievable. You know, incredible.
Yeah.
But at the time of which we're talking, which is, you know, the shadow, he's like growing up in the shadow of Jack Johnson. It made it his opportunity even more difficult because, you know, we'd already talked about this major obstacle of the fact that, you know, they're like, you know, would, you know, Jack Johnson having sort of scandalized, you know, the media was like, you know, no, basically was that created a mentality that in an already segregated era that no black man will ever have a chance to do this to us again.
Right.
You know, so it made the situation with Joe Louis even worse. There was several, we already talked about Harry Wills and Sam Langford, a couple of these great black boxers who were completely passed over had never got their chance at the heavyweight championship because the line was so there was a wall, there was no chance they're not going to get a chance.
All right, so where did we leave off last?
So we talked about the idea of Joe Louis and the family moving from Alabama to Detroit, and
in his early childhood.
Yeah, like Joe grows up in the rural South where he's like everything's laid back and we're talking about Richard Back's book on Joe Louis, which is again a tremendous book. It's called The Great Black Hope, and it's a fantastic read for anybody that's into it. It's my favorite read with regards to Joe Louis. I consider Richard Back the dean of Detroit sports historians.
I gotta link that in the show notes.
Absolutely. But he talks about, he has a really great description. He's got firsthand accounts from, Joe's relatives that grew up with him and friends that knew him as a child. And he just talks about how Joe Joe was a quiet kid, shy kid, grew up, similar stories to like Jack Johnson, where there's like, a lot of times we hear this, like the South was horribly segregated and all this stuff is horrible, but Joe, he didn't have that kind of memories. Joe was like, we played with the neighboring white kids and this, it was just a rural environment where everybody was just kind of, everybody was poor and everybody was living this, just trying to do their best to survive, they weren't, and so Joe went from this environment where they're like, kind of a traveling sharecropper family, working these farms, and they went from there to Detroit, which is like the seventh biggest city in the country. I think it was the seventh biggest city in the country at the time. I have from last week the notes. Detroit's this booming city. He's part of this, they call it the Great Migration North. Yeah, Detroit's the fourth largest city in the country at this point. 1.5 million people in the city, at least in 1926. So Detroit's this booming metropolis, a city on the rise. The automobile industry is in full swing. And, he goes from this laid-back sort of country lifestyle to goes up north to Detroit, which is like he's never seen high-rise buildings. He's never seen, trams that are zipping through the town and neon lights and whatever. This is a completely different environment for him. And one of the things that we sort of left off with was, I think there was a quote in there that we talked about, black people in Detroit were sort of, segregated there was a region of the city called Black Bottom, mm-hmm. which was the area that was predominantly black in Detroit. And in this environment, it was incredibly unsanitary environment. There's a stat that says that deaths outnumbered births in this area, and so there was like just massive thousands of people coming up. There was tons of work in Detroit, at least initially, at least prior to the Great Depression. They were saying that, as people were coming up from the South to the North, that they were grabbing people off the trains and sending them right to the factories to work because, they needed the labor to, because Detroit was that much of a boom town. And so, one of the things we left off was is this idea, like this parallel inside within Black Bottom, which is Joe's mother's a perfect example, like these God fearing, religious types that were, from the, South and that. And then you had, your balance with like the family, the home. And then, right down the street, you had Paradise Valley, which is like, there's every type of vice that you can imagine. And we had this great quote from Richard Back's book talking about just how, like the stores were like fronts for like the gambling halls in it. And there's, all kinds of, there's every manner, in essence, it was a, you had the choice. It was that dual nature, which kind of is like almost a stereotype for a city, mm-hmm. which is like the, do you go with like this solid, it's really the choice for everybody and everything, not just the city, but your dual choice. Do you chase the glitz and glamour and, potentially the crime and the vice, or do you like stay rooted to your morality and, your God fearing ways? And like, what's the trade off? Like, can you stay in the middle somehow? And, do you have to go whole hog into one or the other?
Right.
Can you dance in the line between the two? And so that's kind of where we left off, was this, where, you know, Joe's life and a little bit in Black Bottom and Paradise Valley. And the reason I wanted to leave off there and start today from there is because that was literally the choice that Joe Lewis had. And, you know, we talked about how, you know, he was very quiet. He had, you know, speech impediment. He was not, you know, he went to school from third. He never got past the sixth grade.
Okay.
You know, he's like 15, 16 years old and he's in sixth grade. Yeah. You know, school is not for him. He's not good at it, and he can't focus on anything. And he's just, you know, he's not made to be a book learner, you know. And so what they did was they got him into a trade school, and he tried to be, you know, learn how to do woodworking. So he went to the Bronson Trade School. And so while he's there, he's playing baseball, and he's getting involved with sports. He was a great athlete. You know, he's a great baseball player. But he's also at the same time, right across, you know, this is a guy growing up where he's the seventh of eight children. He's got, you know, the opportunities. He's in the middle of the Great Depression has finally sunk in, and the opportunities are limited. And so, you know, again, this is where, you know, kind of take back to the beginning of the episode where we're saying of all the more, you know, unlikely people that's ever risen to the heights that he would grow to, imagine Joe Lewis at this moment. You see, imagine Joe Lewis in, like, you know, this is 1929, 1930 that we're talking about. This is, you know, he's not Joe Lewis, the star at this point. He's Joe Lewis, the nobody. He's a face in the crowd. He's a face, you know, that's what I mean. Like, you know, so he's, you know, liable, you know, he's, you know, involved with the same temptation as anything. Like, you know, and at this point, what I'm trying to get to is there's a little gang called the Catherine Street Gang,
okay,
which is like they're, Richard Back describes them as his.
It would be better if it was like the St. Catherine Street,
yeah,
Street Gang.
Yeah. No, this is this Catherine Street's a street where Joe Lewis lives. And it's, but they're, you know, Richard Back just has a great description. He calls them like wannabe thugs or something, like wannabe, you know, wannabe gang. There weren't like some, you know, purple gang or anything that was existing at this time. They weren't like this. They were just kind of like some your local toughs, you know. And so anyways, they at one point, they're trying to get Joe Lewis to go get him, you know, Joe to go get, you know, go get involved with like some kind of a criminal activity. Like they're going to go like beat up somebody, rob him or something.
Yeah.
And so they're trying to get him to go. And then this is where an interesting character, a guy, he's a policeman named Ben Turpin, steps in.
Yeah.
And this is like one of these like apocryphal moments in Joe's life that he would always remember from like then on. And it's become like virtually any time you ever hear anything that's talked about Joe Lewis, there's always, you know, they always like, it's like a center point for his youth. No matter how short the story is, there's always a mention of Ben Turpin in this.
Okay.
Who is it? Ben Turpin was a Detroit police, you know, he was a police officer who was like part of this Black Bottom group. And this is really the only quote I want to read today, and because Richard Back has such a great description of Ben Turpin.
Okay.
I wish I would have had a little slide for him, but because there are pictures of him. But anybody that's looking, just do a Google search for Ben Turpin. You'll see a photo of the man. But so in the meantime, I will read off to you this fantastic quote out of, again, this is from Richard Back's book, The Great Black Hope with Joe Lewis. So here it is right here. So on one occasion, gang members tried to convince Joe to grab somebody so they could rob him. Luckily, another set of eyes was trained on Joe. They belonged to a black patrolman named Henderson Ben Turpin. With his stocky build, shaved bullet-shaped head, and brace of pearl-handled revolvers, the brutal and ignorant Turpin, a former shoeshine boy from Kentucky, commanded respect. According to Pearl Johnson, who was raised in a family of 14 on Sherman Street, he usually got it. Johnson would attend evening shows at Catherine Theater and find the off-duty Turpin holding court in the lobby. He'd sit in a chair at the entrance doors and observe people as they came in. If the line in front of the candy counter needed to move, he'd say, "Hey, fella, move up there." And if someone had their hat on, he'd say, "Hey, let's get that hat off." He wasn't paid for it. He was just fulfilling his role as neighborhood guardian. And I'm just going to go on with another little eccentricity. It's Turpin's exploits, which range from acts of bravery to outright buffoonery, could fill a book. An example from his service jacket is typical of the many complaints filed against him. One spring day, officers were dispatched to break up a ruckus caused when Turpin and a female friend were caught flagrante delicto inside a car. Three passerby, suspecting that sexual intercourse was taking place, remarked, "Give it to her, big boy." Turpin, trousers and revolver in hand, held the trio of citizens at gunpoint until he was convinced that they had learned they could not get away with their smart remarks. Such complaints failed to deter Turpin, who was respectfully called Mr. Ben by wary youths. Nobody knows for sure how many people he killed during his quarter century of service. Estimates run as high as 20, including the well-publicized shooting of a Purple Gang bodyguard, Louis Bryant, gunned down one night outside a drugstore on St. Antoine. So I'll give another little section here. Yeah, when he wasn't manhandling loiterers or chasing down thugs, Turpin, who liked his sports, enjoyed dropping in at the Brewster Recreation Center. The two-story red brick building, still standing at 637 Brewster between St. Antoine and Hastings, was the Bernard Ginsburg branch of the Detroit Public Library until an addition and a name change converted it into the city's first community center for black citizens. It opened October 25th, 1929, just 11 days after Turpin had dispatched Louis Bryant to that great speakeasy in the sky. Mm. So
how's Turpin spell his name?
T-U-R-P-I-N. Yep. So anyway, so this guy is like, I mean, the reason I wanted to sort of read that, you know, great little quote about him, the great little, you know, dive into who he was, mm-hmm. is because this guy that guy sort of represents also what we're talking about with this Black Bottom, with this Paradise Valley, where this is a guy who, the more you read about him, there's a little bit more in there about him. You kind of get the sense that this is a guy that, you know, he does care about this local community that he's in. There is this like desire to like try to make his little area better, but at the same time he's also like getting caught in a car with a girl naked and doing, you know, he's got that double-edged sword to his character, to his personality. You see what I'm saying?
I was trying to, while you were talking,
yeah,
I was trying to find a picture.
Yeah.
I found two pictures of his guns, but I couldn't find
them. Oh, really? They have his guns in there? Jeez. No, that's so that's the idea. So maybe next week I'll try to find a picture from. I have a picture of him somewhere.
And there's a old timey silent film.
He's a big guy, and he's got the picture I have is a.
There's in that era, or slightly before that era, there's a slapstick.
But he's famous in Black Bottom, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. That's why there's a whole section there, because he was famous. Yeah. And so, like, if...
Those are famous.
Yeah, so that's what I mean. So, like, you know, if you're Joe Lewis and you're about to go commit this crime or whatever you're about to do...
So he was busting heads down there.
Absolutely.
But he was also reaching out to people.
Exactly.
Saying, hey...
You're better, don't
make me bust your head.
Exactly. And so Joe thanks him, saying this, you know, there's, you know, Joe,
yeah.
You know, look, you know, there's this, you know, Ben Turpin, who's got this major reputation, right? I mean, this is a guy that's like, you know, this guy is kind of crazy, right? Like, you know, he said like his estimate is like 20 people he's killed, you know, and it's just like, this is a guy that is like kind of running his beat. Like like Turpin comes walking down the street and you don't mess with this guy, you know, and it's like, and so, you know, he's like a neighbor, you know, he's almost like as much of a neighborhood, you know, he's like working in the, you know, they talk about how he's like hanging out at the theater, you know, and he's like telling people, hey, put your hat on, you know, hurry up in that line. The line's taking too long. You know, it's like, uh-huh. You know, it's just, he's one of these interesting characters that brings a little bit of a, you know, it sort of brings some of this, you know, this area, you know, this Black Bottom, this Paradise Valley, brings it to life a little bit, especially as it relates to Joe, whereas Joe's about to go do something and Ben Turpin's like, no. You're not going to go do this. You know, you're going to, you know, in the screenplay, I wrote Ben Turpin into the screenplay, is basically him taking Joe back to his mother and saying, your boy's about to do something stupid tonight, you know, and instead of doing that and then talking to Joe saying, you know, hey, kid, you know, because he even said in there, he was talking about how, you know, he had these like sort of attachments to the Brewster Recreation Center. And that's kind of like, you actually named this episode, you know, the Brewster, because that's really where it's an important component. We're talking about Paradise Valley. We're talking about the Den, the, you know, like this, you know, this, the Vice, you know, this, you know, Vice area element. But this Brewster Center is absolutely worth discussing, because this was this, you know, this huge community center that really changed a lot of lives. Mm-hmm. And really, I mean, this you know, really helped to change Joe Lewis's life. And it's impossible to talk about the story of Joe Lewis without talking about the impact of him in the world around this Brewster Recreation Center and trying to sort of bring it to life a little bit.
Yeah. So,
I get
that picture up.
Okay, cool. So the first sort of step, you know, I just want to kind of give you a little bit of an overall summary of the Brewster. So, as it was mentioned in there, as I was sort of tailing off in the quote there about it, it was first started off as a library in the early 1900s, but the library, there wasn't as much need for like this little miniature library as there was for like a larger community center that could, you know, it could do all kinds of stuff. And so they enlarged it and they put a bunch of money into it. And so, you know, the city did. And so it opened proper in 1929. And it, when it opened up, it was this huge, as you know, we have a picture up in the building. It's this huge building. Yeah. And it had classrooms. It had a swimming pool. It had a boxing ring. It had basketball courts. And there was a guy, the main guy that was like in charge of this place was a guy named Leon Toy Wheeler. And I forgot to write down the years that he was involved. But it was like, I mean, it was like for like 30 years. They eventually changed the name from the Brewer Recreation Center to the Brewer Wheeler Recreation Center because he was that important for the, you know, the evolution of that place. So Leon Toy Wheeler, it was like 25 years he was there. It was from like 1920 something to 1940-ish. So Leon Toy Wheeler establishes programs, and so not only do they have the facilities for it, but Leon Toy Wheeler actually established programs, bringing in people that can like teach people that are there, you know, that like in, you know, swimming classes, boxing, track, tennis, drama, dancing, you know, all these different programs for the community to come in there and do this stuff. And so I thought this was a fantastic little fact. At its height, when this, you know, in the 20s and, you know, in the 30s and 40s for this place, there was 81 different clubs.
Wow.
Meeting in the 6 classrooms.
Oh.
Every day.
Wow, okay.
81 different clubs every meeting in the 6 classrooms every single day.
I wonder if this place will get any use.
That's what I mean. Like, this was a, you know, it was a, so yeah, I just wrote up 1969, it was renamed Brewster Wheeler Recreation Center. But think about that, 81 different clubs in those 6 classrooms, you know? This is a major hub of activity.
Right.
And so Joe Lewis, so as I mentioned, Joe was like, you know, Joe's at Bronson Trade School at this point. We're talking about, you know, 1930. And so Joe's about 16 years old. And so Joe's playing baseball with the Bronson, you know, local, you know, the Bronson baseball team, and he's learning how to play soccer. And I just saw a great little story in Richard's back book about how Joe would play soccer in these work boots, and like people worried about their ankles getting broke because he was getting big, and like he's going to kick a ball and he misses and kicks you in the ankle with these work boots on, he's going to break your leg, you know. And so Joe's like, he's just playing sports, and so at one point Joe is playing around. There's a bunch of different stories that talk about, like, Joe was never a violent man ever. Okay, that's what everybody. That was another thing that surprised so many people. He was not a violent person at all. And in fact, that's going to come into play with a component of the story we're talking about. But people are like, we used to see him getting chased by neighborhood bullies.
Right.
Like, he was not a violent man, a kid at all. Like, he was like super sweet, super nice. Last person on earth that anybody would have ever expected, having known him at an early age, that would have ever turned into like this violent boxer. Mm-hmm. They would have never thought that. And so it was really...
a violent boxer.
Well, yeah.
Consider it a violent sport.
Well, we will get to that point. We will get to that point. We will get to that point.
All
and
right.
so, anyways, there's a point where there was like, there's sort of like the, again, like sort of an apocryphal story where, you know, where they're like, you know, there's like this one moment where Joe put on the boxing gloves, you know? But there's a couple different varieties of stories, but they would horse around. At one point they got to set their hands on a set of boxing gloves. Some people say there were, you know, like Richard Back lists a few different, you know, versions of the stories or whatever, that there was like a barn behind their house and the kids were messing around. He like put on boxing boxing gloves and like one punch KO'd somebody, like knocked somebody out with like a single punch. And then his friend, who his name is Thurston McKinney, was like, yo, you know, hey man, you know, there's, you know, you got to get a good punch. For whatever reason, the conversation came up between Thurston McKinney, which is his friend, who was boxing at the Brewster Recreation Center, and tells him, you know, hey, you know, there's a lot of money to be made in boxing. And he shows him a Ring magazine, which was the main boxing magazine at the time. And he shows him how even amateur fighters who were not like big names, were just little local guys, you could make like $5 just in these, you know, in like a merchandise voucher just from fighting in somebody's back room at a bar.
Back then,
yeah.
In the throes of the Depression.
Yeah.
It's cash.
Yeah, it's like $50 or something, you know? I mean, it's like $20-$30 something. So it's not much, but at the same time, it's like, you know, you could even for like little, you know, flea fights that are nobody cares about, you could still make $20-$30, you know, $50 or something. And he's like, you know, in these merchandise vouchers and that. And so it piqued Joe's interest. And so he went to the Brewster with Thurston McKinney, again, who was already sort of involved with the program, the boxing program there that was there. And Joe signed up for a class so the names of the two involved that taught the boxing class was Atler Kid Ellis and another guy named Holman Williams. So both these guys, Kid Ellis was basically Toy Wheeler's like sort of right hand man, and so he taught the boxing class, and Holman Williams was like an actual boxer that was actually at that time like a current boxer, like he was actually developing himself and teaching the kids how to box at the same time, probably making a couple bucks on the side teaching them. Yeah. And so Holman Williams, he was like a great, you know, he was actually like an up and coming boxer at the Brewster Recreation Center. And so this is 1930 when he joins up. And so, like, this is a moment, like, I wrote this into the screenplay, the concept, and Richard Beck does a fantastic job sort of setting the stage for it. This idea that, you know, Joe Louis at this moment is literally just a face in the crowd. You know, there's this Brewster record. You know, with the right sort of pair of eyes, with the right sort of imagination, you can go back, you can look at this building, you can look at this and say, this is like the inner city, black bottom Detroit. You know, there's hundreds, if not, you know, I don't know, 1,000 kids at this place, yeah, playing basketball, boxing, swimming, you know, I mean, this is chaos of activity, yeah, right? Everybody's probably just jammed in there. Sure. Everybody wants to be a boxer. Everybody hears about the money that can be made, even doing $20 and stuff. And so it's just a battle, just, well,
I looked it up. $5 is worth $100.
Okay. Yeah.
It's like $100.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, even something small could be, you know, a little bit of, you know, pocket change. So, so you can imagine this room, you know, your Joe's going in there. He says, shy kid. He doesn't, you know, he's shy, quiet, walking in there. You know, he's not strutting in there like he's about to be the next big thing. He's a face in the crowd.
At the same time. Oh, no, wait, that's
crazy. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No.
So Joe, but he walks into this, and so you can kind of imagine, like, just even going in there, that it would take courage, you know?
Yeah.
And he's just surrounded. I mean, he's, like I say, he's only 4 years removed or, you know, from being down in Buckaloo Mountain, you know, in the shadow of Buckaloo, you know, Mountain, Alabama, mm-hmm, you know, rural South, and now he's in this crazy environment with this frenetic activity, you know, and he's about to start up in a boxing class, yeah, you know, and he's like, and he's going to get probably some big ripped dudes down there, you know, and he's just like, okay, I'm going to go start boxing now, you know.
I'm supposed to be taking violin lessons with this.
Yeah.
One
of the sort of apocryphal components is when Thurston McKinney watches him like hit this other kid, and he's like, you need to ditch the violin and start, you know, picking this up. So anyways, at one point, the more he's doing with this Brewster group, the more he's just falling in love with boxing. Oh. And Joe, this isn't just something where Joe's like, I got to box if I want to make money. Joe actually, you know, he fell in love with it. Okay. He loved doing like conditioning, the road work that comes with running up and down. You know, he loved the training. He loved the discipline of it. He loved, like, the science of boxing and learning how to improve himself. He loved the competition. He liked the camaraderie with all the guys there. There were all sort of these young guys like him that were trying to do something.
Right.
And
something
so,
positive.
Yeah, there was something, you know, just something. He finally found something he was kind of good at. He had a good punch. You know, he could slug. Even from an early age, he could from his very first, knock somebody out, you know. And so you know that this is finally something that he's kind of good at, you know. Even if he's, like, super raw, and he's not, I mean, by no means is he any type of a, you know, mega talent at this moment. He just knows that he can, you know, he's got a solid punch. He's getting kind of big. He's got some muscle on him. Maybe this is something that he might be able to make a couple bucks, but he actually enjoyed it, you see. He actually enjoyed the sport. And so, so he quits. He talks to his mom. It's at this moment that he, you know, actually reveals this to his mom, saying, like, you know, I'm quitting school. I'm quitting the trade school. I'm quitting the violin, and I want to learn to become a boxer. And Richard Beck, again, refer to him for this component, is that, you know, he's like, you know, he talks about how Joe's mom wasn't particularly excited about that fact that he's about to be a boxer. Yeah. But she was somebody that was interested, that liked the discipline, a person that was disciplined. And I think that she saw in Joe what he saw, which was that it was something he was interested in and potentially good at, and something that gave him a little direction, and something that made him, you know, that focused it, you know, that made him disciplined towards a goal. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that you can, you know, that you could appreciate, that, you know, she would say, okay, you know, I trust you, you're my boy, and go do your thing, be careful, don't get, you know, face broke out. And at this moment he kind of tells his mom about it, and she says, okay, you know, the violin lessons are done, you know. And so Joe's, you know, he's growing, and, you know, he's learning how to box a little bit. And at one point in early 1932, so he's been doing this for about a year and a half training. So in early 1932, he gets his first amateur fight.
Oh.
And it's against a guy named, his name is pronounced, it's Johnny, and his last name is Miler, and I believe it's pronounced Myler, Johnny Myler.
Okay.
So Johnny Myler, this is a guy who has had 24 amateur fights under his belt already. This is Joe's very first, like, proper amateur fight that he's ever done. Okay, and so Joe is 154 pounds. He is listed as a light heavyweight, and this is what he fought at for most of his early years, was a light heavyweight, because he wasn't, like, super big, but he was big enough to be considered, like, one tier down from the top. So he's listed he fights as a light heavyweight, and he fights this first fight against Johnny Myler, and Joe was knocked down seven times.
Oh, oops.
Seven times. And so it's just basically...
Hey, he got up.
Well, he got up and he finished the fight on his feet, but he took a beating because Johnny Myler was good, like, real good. And he was a technician. This is a guy that's got a veteran of, Johnny Myler went on to, like, the Olympics, and, like, he had a semi decent career. Mm-hmm. So he was a good fighter, and Joe was just literally just a punch of a fighter. Like, he was just knew how to punch, and he was just at the very, very infancy of what he would become. And so, yeah, so he was knocked down seven times, and as a result, so Johnny Myler got $25 for the fight. Joe Louis got $7, yeah. A $7 merchandise check. You want to put that to your scanner to see how much it was worth?
Am.
It was like 20-30 bucks back then, you know.
No, it's probably 100.
Oh, you said five was like was 100.
Yeah.
Okay.
$7. It's
You said five was 100.
140.
Okay, well, that's not too bad then, I guess. So, anyways, but it's still. But the main thing was is that his, you know, this, you know, there's. You know, you can't ever read into somebody's mind, and there wasn't too much of a, I don't think, a deep dive into this component, but this, you know, the sort of allusion I think that Richard Beck makes, and one that we can appreciate too, especially kind of, you know, what the events that came next, was that this kind of, you know, took the wind out of his sails a little bit. His first amateur fight, and he basically just got pummeled,
right?
And so, Yeah. So and so it was actually during like right around this time during this fight that his name was that he dropped the barrel from his name at least for the boxing purposes. Mm-hmm. It started just be going as Joe Lewis, and so there's of course rampant speculation as to why. And one of the very first legend of the story is that it was that so that his mom wouldn't find out that he was boxing. That's the most obvious example of why Joe Lewis's name was shortened from Barrel to Lewis. And so, you know, it just there's, you know, who knows? The more people we talk to about the story, right, the more people are probably going to say, that's why he changed his name.
So, well,
but the thing about it is, right at this moment is when his mom was already finding out about it. So how, you know, was he really trying to hide it?
We'll have to talk to Joe.
Exactly. He's a perfect person to talk to. Yes.
That's on tap. We're going
to
talk
to perfect person to talk to. Yes.
The third.
Maybe we can clarify that because it's.
By JoJo.
And, yeah.
Just opened a kitchen, a restaurant here in Detroit.
Yeah.
The Southern Kitchen.
Yeah.
It's right on Woodward. It's only open from, it's a breakfast brunch kind of place. It's only open till I think, 3 or 4 or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's like it's a breakfast brunch kind of place. Really, really good. They got this, like this chicken leg, turkey, like a, not chicken leg, turkey leg.
Turkey leg. It's like my favorite things in the world, man.
But it's like covered in like mac and cheese.
What? Oh my God! I've never had that. I've had turkey legs across the world, but I haven't had it.
No, it's a turkey leg. They do this crazy.
But now with some macaroni on it, man, that's next level. Yeah.
Amazing food there, right on Woodward.
They should sell those things at. Do they sell those at like events and stuff? Like some of the music festivals. I mean, I know it's new, so there hasn't been too many of them. But
this is their first.
They need to take that out for like street food. Like
just launched. I mean, it just.
Well, they. If I talk to him, I mean, that's he's got. I mean. Because that's what turkey legs are ideal for that street food where you're just selling turkey legs to people. Those things, they'd be selling those all, because there's right around the corner, there's the Dally in the Alley, there's all these different shows, jazz festivals and stuff.
Yeah.
So
talk to JoJo.
Exactly, that's a perfect person name, yeah. So the obvious reason or one of the, you know, the a reason it, a solid reason, you know, is that it was just a shorter name to write down for the paperwork.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be as something as basic and simple as that. You know, Joe Lewis sounds like a little more of a condensed boxing name, but at the same time, he's so early in his career. Would he really be like, oh, Joe Lewis is such a, you know, that's a kind of a big deal, like remove your last name, you know, like and say, oh, well, this is a more condensed boxing name. Like, you know, that's what I'm saying. That will be a good question, but it's at this moment anyways that's when this starts to evolve. That's when he starts to just go by Joe Lewis in the boxing ring. So anyway, so following this defeat to Johnny Myler, Joe takes a job at Briggs Auto Body, and he takes a job in this auto body factory, just doing like this grueling work, like pushing auto body chassis to get them painted, and it's like this hot, you know, really brutal job. And so he's like that's what I'm saying, like the kind of results after, like I think that his boxing sort of slowed down a little bit while he focused on work. Because I mean, how can you focus on boxing as much when you're working these brutal job where you're just going home and you're just, you know, going home just to get enough sleep for the next day, you know? It's just, and so, but it's at this moment that his two friends, the one friend that kind of encouraged him in the beginning, which was Thurston McKinney, and also Thurston McKinney and another guys, you know, the original Holman Williams are saying, hey man, you got to come back, you know, this is you're good, you know, we know you took a beating in the first one, but you're good, you know, you got some talent. And so they're you know, encouraging him to stick with it and to come back. And so he ends up coming back and he fights a second amateur fight against a guy named Otis Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
And he pounds this guy.
Oh.
And so this kind of revigorates his enthusiasm for it. And then this fight, so he keeps on fighting these little amateur bouts and he wins 13 more.
Whoa.
In a row. So in every one of these fights are knockouts. These are not just like little powder puff point victory type things. These are all knockouts. He's knocking these guys out.
Okay.
Yeah. And so this is a
victory.
Yeah, so these are component, this idea is what is going to sort of be Joe's defining characteristic of his entire career.
Right.
And this is something that it's important to understand about him going for all the rest of the stories that we're talking about going forward is that this is what would be the the opportunity for him. At the very center of all the different things that are revolving around him, okay, his losses, and he's going to lose again. See here in a second, we'll talk about it. The negative things, that, you know, the obstacles that are overcome. The one singular sort of like center, the foundation of what he, of the opportunities that he's going to get,
yeah,
is the power that he's got in his fists.
Okay.
Because this man is an absolute knockout artist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In at this point in his career, he is raw. He is as raw as you get. But if he gets his hands on you, you're done. Okay, but the problem is that other fighters know this, and so they're dancing around, they're winning on points, they're Johnny Myler's case, he was able to knock Joe down, you know, quite a few times, but he's improving, and he's constantly improving, and so the more impact, the better trainers he's going to get that teach him the science of boxing, the more that knockout power is going to be refined, and it's going to be like, you know, when he gets to the point where Joe is like just a tactician in the ring, that's what's going to change him into one of the greatest fighters, if not the greatest boxer that ever lived, is because he always had the knockout power. But the problem was that, you know, especially early on, was that these other, but he, you know, he was, you know, his, he didn't, you know, the scientific components, the footwork wasn't there, the jabs and the different, you know, the setups, things that you need in order to be a successful boxer for a, you know, for a profession. All these other guys had all those things. But, you know, but the more, as we're going to see, the more he learns these skills, the more he is just going to become, like, the greatest boxer of all time, you see?
That statue downtown is just that forearm in the fist.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. Like, it was that knockout power. Right. What was going to, you know, that's the central core component of everything. And there's other things that are gonna, you know, that's gonna tie in with it. But it's at this moment that we're seeing this. Like, so he's got
that's his signature.
That's his signature is the knockouts. These knockouts. So, anyways, So at this moment, so he, like I say, we've got these two guys teaching him, like this kid Ellis and Holman Williams. But what's also emerging is, and that's why I called this entire episode the Brewster,
right,
because what's happening at the Brewster now is just a fascinating story. And I really encourage anybody to really get Richard Back again does a phenomenal job on this, that he talks about this idea that this whole group, it wasn't just Joe, mm-hmm, at the Brewster at this point. Joe was one amongst many. There's a bunch of different guys who were all, they were all good. There was like six or seven guys that were just tremendous boxers in this era. And Joe, like Richard Back has quotes about these other boxers where he's talking about these guys and he's saying, you know, like the other boxers, like at the time, Joe wasn't even the best guy at the Brewster.
Mm.
He wasn't even any, he was like, I mean, he was good. He was a prospect, but he's like, but we were all prospects. And there was other guys that literally that like were, we all looked at as better than Joe as a potential pro, you know, future pro. But at the same time, It was an era. It was a, you know, sort of a class of boxers. They were all, you know, sort of around the same age. They were all teaching each other how to get better. They were sparring against each other. They were all learning. You know, they were all teaching each other, fighting against each other, and all improving at sort of the same time. And there was a definitive style that was coming out of Detroit, that was coming out of the Brewster Center,
okay,
and it was called the Detroit style, and it was all geared on the left, like you're like, you know, that a lot of people are right handed, so it's the right which is the sort of power punch, but the Detroit style was the use of the left, like a lot of times when a boxer is lined up, it's the jab that sort of sets up the right in this, right,
mm-hmm,
and so in this case. You know, at least the Brewster style specifically was the left jab, the right, and then a left hook. That was the, you know, like this combination that like finished with the left. And so, but the Detroit style in general, but if you like the Detroit style was so called because you were good with your left in general, you were good with it, whether it was the jab, whether it was the hook, whether it was the cross, whatever it was.
And that wasn't common amongst boxers.
Well, the people use the left. It's not like they just didn't. They only use their right. You know what I mean? They always use. Everybody used their left.
Sure.
But it was like it was. But it was their definitive thing. Right. That like it's not Detroit style unless you're good with it.
Right.
Unless you're real good with it. So they spent a lot of time developing that left as like their signature thing. And you know, like I say, there's you know, I haven't really looked into New York style and Chicago style. Maybe they'll use their left too. Maybe that was a good thing. You know, the thing. But they viewed it, and it's not just Richard Back that says that. I've seen this all over the place, that this idea of the Detroit style was, you know, the usage of the left, and not just like good at it, but like you were almost defined by how good you were with it. I think that's why they called it that. Was like they all judged each other based on how good each other was with that left. You see what I'm saying? Like how they could use it to set up the right, or how the right could set up a left. You know what I mean? Like whatever it was, but that left, it was, so whenever that left came out to be effective, you can almost imagine, like, oh, damn, he caught him with that left hook, you know, that left, that Detroit left, you know, like, you can see that, it just became that thing, you know, but with these guys all, you know, all these guys that were sort of part of this, and I just want to read off a few of their names, because I got these guys.
Yeah.
So you've got, I just have a list here, notable Brewster boxers. We mentioned Holman Williams, we mentioned Thurston McKinney. Both these guys were gold gloves. We're going to talk about the Detroit gold gloves here in a second. But both these guys are gold glove champions. Clinton Bridges, Curtis Shipp, Eddie Futch. Eddie Futch would go on, he was a gold glove champion. He would end up going on to be the trainer of Joe Frazier.
Oh, wow.
One of the, you know, Joe, tremendous. Tremendously famous boxer. Dave Clark, who was one of the, end up being one of the champions of 35 in addition to Joe. He was like an AAU champion. Lorenzo Pack, AMC Rinson. A guy named Walter Smith.
These guys are all coming out of the Brewster.
All coming out of the Brewster. And Walter Smith would end up becoming the trainer for Tommy Hearns.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It's like not only were they good, but they would have major impact on boxing. Yeah. And then another guy named Walker Smith, who was only a child at this moment, but as Joe started to sort of pick up steam and getting knockouts, he had his own little cult following of younger kids that were at the gym. And this is one of these younger kids that was at the gym at this moment. Mm. And he would like carry Joe's bags for him, like to the, I mean, Joe was like nobody at this point,
yeah.
And he's got a fan, you know, and this little kid from the neighborhood, and this kid Walker Smith, he would move out of Detroit 5-6, you know, a couple 3 years after this, and move out to the Harlem in New York, where he would become Sugar Ray Robinson, who is some people say is the greatest boxer who ever lived as far as pound for pound.
Right.
Sugar Ray Robinson was a tremendous fighter,
yeah.
and that was who was carrying Joe's. I mean, he was at the Brewster, seeing Joe.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? Like this is this era that, I mean, this is like a golden era for this place. And so and a guy that, as we're going to talk about him more in the next episode, a guy named Stanley Evans, who has really become Joe's nemesis in this.
Uh-huh.
Who's like going to come out of this is like just two, like, you know, Joe and Stanley Evans are the two big names that are going to sort of like emerge out of this. And they're going to battle it out for, you know, who's the number one guy from the Brewster. That's what, you know, we're going to get into that next episode. But another little random fact that I saw when I was putting these notes together was that the Harlem Globetrotters played their first road game ever at the Brewster in 1932 on the basketball courts at the Brewster.
Nice.
Harlem Globetrotters started out there. I mean, Yeah,
well,
yeah, but this was a road game.
Road game.
Yeah. Their first road game is at the Brewster in Detroit.
Nice.
Like, I mean, that's how influential this building is. I mean, this is the echo of, you know, thousands of voices, and you know, this is history right here. This is boxing history par excellence. I mean, you know, this if the walls could talk.
It's another one of those things about Detroit. And it's like, you know, people is like, oh, I can't wait to get out of here. And I'm like, go.
Yeah, this
I
is.
I love this place.
I mean, there's the, I mean, the voices of this place. I mean, it's the you know, the ghosts, the voices, the, you know, the stories that come out of that place.
Detroit's,
you could do
for so many things.
Absolutely.
Music, cars, boxing.
But if the walls could talk, you know,
yeah.
If the walls could talk, what would they say about this era? And that's what I'm saying. Like, that's why it's. That's why I love being able to chance to do the show and to kind of isolate, you know, these moments, because this, all we're talking about right here, would just be a 1 minute, a 30 second, not even 10 second mention in a documentary.
Yeah, you know, get all those guys' names.
No, definitely not. You know, and that's what I'm saying. Like, and it's cool because this is the era that Joe. This is, you know, and to skip over this, to brush over this, isn't just some ancillary fact. This is the foundation of Joe's career. Mm-hmm. Was being like the, you know, from the moment he walks in these doors, and he's just the, having the guts to walk in. And I've been there. I my whole life growing up, I was always every 2 years we moved to a different city. And I specifically remember my first day walking onto a football team. I'd really never even played football before, and I'm walking into a new school. You know, I felt like I was, you know, I wasn't the biggest guy in the world, and I'm walking on, you know, I'd never played football before. Somebody from the school said, hey, I think they told my mom, hey, your son should go out for the football team. You know, I'm walking on this football field, never really, you know, I've played a little bit of backyard football, but I've never played with pads on, stuff like this. And you're walking out there, and there's this huge group of guys, and there's a lot of them, half of them are older than you. They're all smashing each other, and you're like, God, where am I at? You know? Yeah. And so, you know, for anybody that's been in that situation, that you're new in a new team, which I'm sure that almost everybody's been in that spot, and that's what Joe's walking into. And right. but then you know, from that, you know, initial era, he becomes part of something, and part of like sort of a golden era of boxing, of these up and comers that are all coming up at this exact same moment. So I just think it's a fascinating, like, sort of a, you know, a little bit of a deep dive into where he comes from.
Yeah.
And so, you know, of course, he's poor as a church mouse.
Yeah.
This is a guy that, like, his boxing gloves are like tatters. You know, he's wearing shoes that are rags. You know, Richard Beck talks about how there's a quote in there where Joe said, like, the only meat they ever ate was hot dogs. Well, that's all they had. That's the only meat they knew growing up was hot dogs. They never had anything else. Like, that was literally it. I mean, that's all they had, you know, hot dogs and maybe some ice cream every once in a great while as a treat. But, you know, he's doing road work in raggedy shoes, boxing with raggedy gloves. You know, they all had nothing. This is the middle of the Great Depression. So you can just kind of get this air. I mean, it's like, it's a little bit reminiscent of Rocky where, sure, you know, it's this sweaty gym.
Yeah.
Nobody, you know, everybody's wearing raggedy shirts, you know, they're just punching each other and stuff. You know, it's a great little.
I never brought up the black bottom mask.
Well, that's what, so yeah, so we'll get to that. We'll finish up with all those pictures there.
I've had the picture of the first.
Oh, have you? Okay, good. Okay, we'll get to it. It'll flow in. You know, so we'll finish off the entire thing with that. Yeah. Well, yeah. The time flies in here, man. You know. So anyways, just to kind of wrap it up. So like, we're gonna sort of finish off with this. We're gonna talk about we're gonna finish off with, you know what? We're at an hour. We'll finish. I'll start with this next week. We'll talk about where Joe's going.
Gloves,
yeah.
Right?
Well, yeah. We'll start off with the Golden Gloves because it actually it's in a little bit of a longer story, and we can incorporate this in. No one needs to rush through this. Yeah. No, we'll talk about the map now. We'll finish off with this.
Bring that map up?
Yeah. So I have the map because it gives an idea of where the sort of Black Bottom and Paradise Valley areas were in Detroit
off the Grand Circus.
And so if, when the highways came in, when specifically 75, right, those highways sliced right through it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they tore up that area and you know, chunked it up so that the area, because a lot of people say, I was watching a couple videos today about it, and they were talking about the sadness of that, of the destruction of this, of these areas, because it could be like a modern day Bourbon Street, like this modern day, like, you know, with this, you know, this legacy of this black community that was there for so long,
right,
that it, you know, the memories of it.
There were some nice architecture.
Oh, and the videos that I saw, these interviews with former residents of Black Bottom from the 30s and 40s, you know, there's this initial presumption that this is like a horrific ghetto. Shacks, horrific ghetto, toilet, little dump or whatever like this. But their memories were all like, this was the coolest place, man. Like, everybody knew each other. It was, you know, there was the Paradise Valley was a vice, but it was also home to some of the greatest like entertainers, like the biggest names in the country. When they would come, like jazz and all these different, like, you know, musicians were coming through, they were playing in Paradise Valley. Like, it wasn't just, you know, it wasn't just a,
still to today, the second largest theater district outside of New York City is in Detroit.
Yeah, well, this, but yeah,
we have the second largest theater.
Really? I didn't know that. No, that's
yeah.
But it,
currently we have Yeah.
But so one, that's what was kind of one of the cool things was, is that this Paradise Valley, it wasn't just this like den of villainy with like where no respectable person would go there. In fact, a lot of respectable people went there because it was like, because it was a little bit of an outlaw area. So it was like, so you would have a little bit more, you know, some of the more edgier performances, and therefore it was kind of hip. It was kind of like the place to be, you know? And that's what I mean. So a lot of you, anybody that's listening to this, if you have
this
a chance,
parallels to the Harlem Renaissance.
Yeah. It's so
guys in the poetry and everything.
There's a ton of great material. If you go on, you know, YouTube is full of all these different interviews and videos with like remembering Paradise Valley, remembering Black Bottom Detroit, and a lot of their memories are like it was like the coolest place, and what a tragedy it was that the highway when they built 75 ran right through it and carved up this district, and so there's actually components of, you know, people trying to bring it back, some of these elements of it, and that's why I have this other picture, which is showing the current Brewster Recreation Center.
Yeah, that's most of the time.
Yeah, well, if you look at this picture, there's an effort, because it's just, dude, it's been stripped out by, the copper's been stripped out of the walls, everything's been torn out of this building, it's just it's completely covered in spray paint,
yeah.
The interior, every nook and cranny is covered with spray paint, it's just a shell. Yes, but if you see this photo here, there's actually been a little bit of a movement. I saw another article from 2019 of some people trying to make some headways into it. But if you look at that bottom picture of this thing where they're talking about sinking $50 million investment in it, do you recognize the guy at the podium?
No, who's that?
It's Joe Jr. It's just a small picture, I know, but he was there with Duggan and these talking about renovating this Brewster Recreation Center.
Was that recently?
Yeah, well, that was from 2015.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but this, so Joe Jr., that's what was kind of surprising, because he gave a speech at this thing.
Okay.
And so I want to talk to him about his, you know, involvement in this whole thing.
Yeah.
Because just think about when I first moved to Detroit, I had this.
I made him cry last time.
Did you?
Yeah.
Well, when I first
talking about his dad, and he ended up. We were at the. It's on. If anybody rolls back, if you missed that, I put it out as a video episode. So Facebook or YouTube, it's there
for your.
I put it up on City of Champions.
Oh, did you? Okay, good.
It's there. So we sat down with him at the restaurant. Talked about the restaurant. Was talking about his dad. You know, and why it was important, and the family and the legacy and everything.
Yeah.
And he got all choked up. And he was crying.
I'm sure, you know,
like,
yeah.
It's like, don't make JoJo cry.
Yeah, but his dad was a great guy. You know, that's what I'm saying. You look at these things, you look at the sort of sum total of Joe's life, he was one of the biggest issues that he had was that he was so generous.
Yeah.
He gave away his money. Like gave it all away. Like he was like the amount of people that he helped, grow, you know, as he went on through his life was astonishing. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, I have all these quotes in my book, but there's many others where it's like examples of Joe, like at Christmas, he would stand on the street, he would have like these little envelopes with a bank account number already. There's like, he would set up like 100 bank accounts. And then in the envelope, there was like a bank account number and a quarter. And then he would give the envelopes to these kids on the street corner for Christmas, and with the quarter that they had to go and put the quarter in their bank account to get it going. And that's how they would start their first bank account, was the 25 cents Joe gave them.
Wow.
You know, like, I mean, it's stuff like that. It's like these are these people that give back to the community.
Yeah.
In a legitimate way. Like, that's just one example. Like, there was so many people he gave money to for starting businesses. I mean, that, like, you know, eventually the taxes from giving all this money away, like, he was, you know, he earned this money, gave it away, and then have to pay taxes on it and have the money to pay it. Yeah. And so he would give on to this cycle where he would have to go box again and box more and more and more. And then eventually, the money ran out. The fight sort of ended, and he still owed all this money.
So I was talking about, I put the logo up. I grabbed it, Southern Kitchen, Joe Louis Southern Kitchen. I threw the logo out there. I pulled it down. So we're going to talk to JoJo.
Yeah, but can you imagine, like, you know, this, you know, they got the Brush Park going, which is a sort of an area nearby there. This is right next to Ford. If you can't see it, it's the Brewster is very nearby, like Ford Field. It's just north of Ford Field.
Mm-hmm.
I just
breathe life back into the train station.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff happening.
Well, yeah, what they were talking about for this, I saw a 2019 article where there was people talking about renovating it and using it for like turning it into a restaurant with an actual little bit of a community center part of it and like a sort of a signature, like a key component. But like I say, when I first moved to Detroit, man, I had a vision that this city was going to come back and go do all this great stuff. And I'm still optimistic, man. You know, it's and like stuff like that, you know, it's just thinking about all the incredible things that happened at this Brewster Recreation Center and the idea that it could make a comeback, you know. I mean, it's absolutely fitting with the motto Detroit, you know, from the ashes, you know, we will rise. I mean, that's literally the motto of Detroit.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's like, what a better example, a testament to that idea than if something like that happened with the Brewster. Because, like, I mean, you know, the state of it, at least the photos I've seen of it, it's for what it used to be and for what it was and for the impact that it had, mm-hmm. it's sad.
Right.
It's flat out sad. It's just it's been stripped of all of its copper. It's just completely covered head to toe. There's not another inch of space inside the building without graffiti on it. And even the image with Joe Louis has got somebody spray painted on his arm like a tattoo. It says mom on it with a heart and stuff. Like, you know, it's, I mean, at least they didn't spray his face out or something, but, you know, the entire place is completely covered. Outside is a little bit better, but there's graffiti all over the walls. The basketball courts, the outdoor tennis courts, the basketball are all tore up. You know, it's like, but what, you know, like, I just think that it's something that, you know, the last mention I saw of renovating was 2019, and in 2015 supposedly there was some city grant money trying to go towards it. But if there could get use out of it, it wouldn't have to be like a donation going towards it. It could be used as a crown jewel of a, you know, of people that were actually going to use it.
Right.
It would actually become financially viable because it'd be like, you know, it'd produce money, or you would actually have actual value and actually have, you know, it wouldn't just be like a cherry case. And that's my hope. That's my overall hope with Detroit and everything, is that people, it becomes like an actual place where people use stuff like that again, you know?
All right, man, we're going to continue on. Lots and lots more to do with Joe Louis.
Yeah.
Lots and lots more to do with the 1935.
Tons year. More, yeah.
And Detroit, the City of Champions, the podcast. Thanks for being with us. We'll do it again very, very soon. Put them up.
You got it, Jamie. Hit it. You timed it perfect.